Welcome back to Innovation. We're broadcasting from the Kirby Family Studio in our Sioux Falls studios. I'm Kara Hetland, and joining me now on the phone from Dakota State University in Madison, I have a couple three students and a professor. Dr. Michael Gaylor is an associate research professor of chemistry at Dakota State University. Dr. Gaylor, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Kara. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you again, too. And we have three students, Hope Jutinen, Lucas Linen, and Valley Swenson. Is that right?
Vale.
Thanks for being here.
It's okay. It's very common.
All right. And Hope, I want to start with you because you are the principal investigator and lead author of the article that you wrote. So let's start with you and talk a little bit, Hope, about your research as an undergraduate student at Dakota State.
Yeah, so I've been involved in quite a few projects here at DSU, but this most recent work is my very first author publication. I've had a lot of hands-on experience that's been preparing me for grad school, especially on this project, doing all of the experimental work and helping with prepping the manuscript, really doing all the work from beginning to end has just been a great experience, really getting me ready for graduate school.
And so tell me what the project is.
So we were looking at the conversion of anthracene to anthraquinone under various temperature regimes, and we were looking at the kinetics. So basically the rate at which conversion happened at the various temperatures we tested.
Okay, so bring that down and help me understand really what this is.
Okay, so we have anthracene, which is a compound, and we put it into crucibles, and then we heated those crucibles at various temperatures. Our highest temperature was 250 degrees Celsius. So that was extremely, extremely hot. So that was the hottest one we tested. And then we just went down incrementally to 225, 200, all the way down to 0 degrees Celsius. And we were just really looking to see how much anthraquinone was produced at all of these temperatures. So obviously at our coldest temperature, we saw no anthraquinone production from anthracene. And at our hottest temperature, we saw lots and lots and lots of anthraquinone produced.
And Dr. Gaylor, what is anthraquinone?
Okay, let me jump in here for some bigger picture stuff here, Kara, just for all of the listening audience. That was a very detailed description. Those are the kinds of things that I'm working very hard to get the students to be fluent in, because this is the language that they will speak as they move into doctoral programs,
right,
and are required to be independent scientists. But the basic idea is this. These are molecules, these are chemical compounds that are common throughout our solar system, indeed throughout our galaxy, as far as we know, throughout the universe. And we find these chemical compounds at relatively high concentrations in, say, for example, meteorites. The idea is that meteorites bombarded our planet and bombard many other planets throughout the galaxy over hundreds of millions of years, bringing these molecules to planetary environments where there are maybe no life forms. The prevailing idea is that these compounds, once they have been deposited on a particular planet, say our primitive Earth, would then undergo reactions with minerals and rocks and in a watery environments to produce other molecules, in this case, this anthraquinone that Hope was talking about, that has biological properties. These chemicals are very active in various processes in our cells. And so the prevailing idea is that much of what we see as biological chemistry today was likely happening on our planet some 4 billion years ago, which may have given rise to the more complex life chemistry that we see today.
And what are we going to do with this knowledge?
Well, that is a great, that's a super question. And I get a lot of parents and so forth coming through the university all the time saying, well, that's great. Why are we doing this? This kind of research has direct bearing on our search, that is to say humanity's search, for life forms on other planets. One of the big questions in science right now, perhaps the biggest, is where did we come from? Why does life happen here? Does it happen on other planets? And these small incremental steps, these smaller in scope experiments that my students and I are doing here, are demonstrating pathways by which rocks and water and meteorite constituents can all interact to produce molecules that we see in living cells today. And so this is very, very exciting. And all of this informs NASA and other exploration societies, space exploration agencies around the world. All of this kind of research is informing how we design experiments and planetary travel missions to look for living things on other planets. So that's the real big picture we're working at here.
And I'm going to toss it to Lucas now and ask you about your experience in working on a project like this that has been recognized by a science journal.
It has been a trip. It's something that I've really enjoyed learning about and experiencing, and it will provide me with a lot of experience and knowledge going forward into graduate school.
And so what do you want to do after you? What year are you, Lucas?
This is my last year.
You're a senior. So what's next for you? What are your plans?
I hope to get into graduate school for possibly archaeological reasons or even cancer research.
So you're not going to stick with this kind of a project?
If I do go into archaeology, I could use what I've learned here and use it with a bit more recent time frames instead of millions of years ago.
So your group of students as undergraduates, you're really not sticking together going forward into graduate school. You all have different plans and different dreams, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so, but what did you learn about working together as a group? Did you always agree on everything?
There were times where we debated over the results, but we've mostly worked well together to produce a product.
Okay, and Hope, as the principal investigator, talk a little bit about your plans for the future and what this experience has brought for you.
So I plan on attending graduate school as well in biochemistry or pharmacology, and being the principal investigator on a paper has really taught me how to take my own ideas and see a whole project through from beginning to end. So no matter what I pursue in graduate school, these lessons I'm learning in lab today and previously will follow me throughout my graduate school career. So even though I might not be pursuing a graduate school that does prebiotic chemistry, I will still be taking the lessons learned with me to whatever grad program I end up at.
And we're talking about conducting experiments, taking in data, writing a paper, having it make sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Taking that data and making it into a dialogue.
Yes. Yes, that is a big part of it. Being able to communicate the science we find, the results we obtain, to the greater scientific audience and to just the greater overall community as well. That's always a big part of science.
Okay, and you had another partner who wasn't able to be here, correct, Hope?
Yes, that is correct. Bree was not able to be with us today.
Okay, and Bale Swenson you're sharing a phone, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And do you want to hand that to him?
Hello.
Okay, this is Vale?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, sorry, her. My apologies. I got confused for who was talking and correcting my name. So thank you for that.
No, you're fine.
Okay, so Vale, talk a little bit about your involvement and what your hopes are for the future.
So I actually wasn't personally involved on this project that was just published, but I'm involved on the follow-up study that we're doing now that's related to this research. But being involved in the follow-up study has really made me appreciate how much amazingly hard work went into producing this paper and how awesome my colleagues are.
And the follow-up is looking at what?
It's basically looking at the same system, but exploring additional compounds. So what Hope and Bree and Lucas and Dr. Gaylor did was looking at anthracene conversion to anthraquinone with a clay called montmorillonite. And for the follow-up study, we're looking at additional clays like kaolinite.
Okay. And Dr. Gaylor, I want to bring you back onto the phone now and talk a little bit about just about the experience that you, as a professor there at Dakota State, give to your students. Because you don't wait for students to become, you know, in a grad program. You give them that kind of experience as an undergrad.
Oh, absolutely. My whole program here, Kara, is grounded very firmly in this idea of bringing students like these remarkable young kids into my lab and exposing them to what are some pretty complex ideas. And often I involve them in projects where, frankly, they may not have even had adequate coursework to really get a handle on what are these real, real big picture ideas that I kind of laid out for you a little bit earlier. I bring them in. I have them read basic review papers and things to get used to kind of the scientific jargon. And as they progress into their upper division classes, their research experiences now start to tie into all of the theoretical ideas that we typically would present in the classroom setting. And so I'm a big proponent of incorporating research into my teaching. And in fact, all the students that you have spoke to today are all in a new course right now that I have designed and am teaching, which is very much a research intensive course called prebiotic chemistry. Basically, how does chemistry become biology? This is one of the premier, perhaps the biggest question in science right now is if all of the things that we've been talking about exist all over the galaxy, why is it that we're not seeing these living things? And so these are hugely profound questions for young students to grapple with early on. And as you can hear from speaking with these very bright students, these highly motivated students, it's paying big dividends for them. But it is not without challenge. There are many days in the lab, weeks, in fact, where we sit around and say, what does this mean? We don't understand this. We're chasing things in the lab. This is the nature of the scientific process. There are long periods of time when we don't get a result that that means much of anything, and that is really drives the learning and the critical inquiry and those things that are going to be crucial for them to be successful in rigorous doctoral programs.
And are the questions and the research or that you're looking for answers, or they come from you, or do you encourage students to find their own area that they want to study?
Oh, I definitely encourage the students to move in the direction that most excites them. Though sometimes it can be a detriment in terms of being too distracted and diluting one's efforts too much in a research setting. I do get very excited when students like these that you've spoken to come to me and articulate to me these sort of sophisticated ideas that they would like to investigate in the lab. This has led to my program being very, very, very interdisciplinary. You and I have spoken before about our so-called pumpkin project. Well, this is very much on the opposite end of the spectrum from the search for how does geochemistry give rise to biochemistry. And that's just an example of how I have my program has been tailored to a large extent by the interests and sort of excited passions of my students. And sometimes, again, we get a little distracted by trying to do too many things at once. And that, too, is an extraordinarily valuable lesson for young researchers like these, and as well as myself, a much more veteran researcher. But that's what excites us.
Talk a little bit about how easy is it for an undergraduate student to have a paper submitted to a science journal? Talk about that process.
Yes, it is not an easy thing. Certainly at larger schools, the most ambitious students manage to find professors who are excited about investing in them and cultivating them to the level of being able to produce a manuscript that can be polished by more a more veteran professor like myself into something that we can submit with confidence. But this is not a trivial task. Writing a paper that advances a cutting edge idea that is going to go out for scientific peer review and scrutiny is can be intimidating even for the most veteran scientists. And so for young students like these, it can be very, very intimidating. But the payoff is huge. Our paper is being read by people. It has led to new collaborations with people at larger institutions, about which I'm very, very excited, which is bringing the Dakota State University name and brand to places that it has never been. And when these students can download this paper and share it with their families and their peers and other professors, it's a huge, huge thrill that really, really motivates them. And though there have been months and months and months of painful experimental procedures and trying to understand what's gone wrong in the lab, again, the very nature of science, when that paper comes out and they get that immediate thrill and that sort of reinforcement, that's really what it's all about. But it is not a trivial task, and it is a lot of work to take inexperienced students and train them to be functional, practicing independent scientists that can run at least a component of a very novel investigation like this.
And Hope, you started this project how long ago?
We started this project last fall semester, I believe.
Okay. So, and then you started writing the paper when? In the spring?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We started writing it in the spring, during the spring semester.
Okay. And quickly, Dr. Gaylor, before I let you all go, I just wanted a quick update on the pumpkin project.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm excited to talk about that, but you probably haven't given me enough time.
But well, we'll have you back, too, to talk more, but just a quick update would be great.
Quick update. Here's what's happening. You may remember our last conversation. The original pumpkin sample led to a tremendous outpouring from the local community, from people who had preserves of various varieties in their basements that had been prepared back, going all the way back to 1950. And through some very generous donations from the community, we ended up getting about 35 more of these perfectly sealed preserves that were prepared in Moody County in the period 1950 to 1953. And Lucas, in fact, was my summer research fellow this summer, and his job this summer was to really work through all of the analysis, running all the samples, collecting the data, and that has consumed his entire summer. Again, going back to this idea of how sort of labor-intensive and time-intensive these sorts of novel investigations are. The cool thing is that we now have a really, really awesome data set that we are now sifting through and trying to make sense of, and we're comparing this information to modern-day preserves, and it is shaping up to be a really, really interesting story. All of this is preparing us to open that 1920s pumpkin sample with extreme confidence.
Right, and I want to be there when you do.
I will be very excited to have you there.